Okay, it's another edition of the Falls Cast, brought to you by the Falls Free Press in beautiful Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, where it's been about 80 degrees today. We're going to have a roundtable discussion here for you as usual. First, we just want to let you know that immediately following our discussion here, we're going to have an interview with a candidate, former candidate for the 36th District seat of the State House of Representatives, A.J. Harris, who's a Cuyahoga Falls native and had a really inspiring campaign that was well-received in Cuyahoga Falls. I was able to talk to him yesterday, the 13th. Today is July 14th. It was a good conversation. So stay tuned for that after our discussion here. Also, just want to make sure that we mention that the Falls Free Press continues to produce written material. We do a lot of different kinds of articles, everything from news and politics to features of local businesses, reviews of art shows and theater productions. Sometimes we do features of local musicians and local artists, all kinds of different things. And also, of course, Tap Talk, which is our review of area breweries now that Cuyahoga Falls is the brewery capital of Northeast Ohio. I don't know if that's actually true, but it seems like it. We have lots of content that we want to continue to produce, but we are but a few people who are concerned citizens trying to produce this alternative media content for the Cuyahoga Falls community. And we would love your help. So if you're listening to the Falls Cast, if you're keeping up with articles, if you're on our social media and you're thinking, you know, I could contribute something to that, we would love to have you. Please reach out to us, fallsfreepress@gmail.com. You can contact us through our social media accounts on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and of course, fallsfreepress.com. You can contact us through there too. So please do reach out to us if you're interested in producing any kind of content. One of the number one things that we editors hear is that it is scary to write. And we totally understand that. And that's why we have editors. So if you're interested in writing something, don't worry about how you feel about your writing skills. Chances are you are your own worst critic anyway, but we have people who will help whip it into shape if it needs it. And it probably doesn't need it as bad as you think it does. So that's our spiel about getting people to come help us write. And again, stay tuned for our interview with A.J. Harris right after our conversation today. We are joined this wonderful July afternoon by some of our favorite Falls casters. We have, as usual, our arts editor, my friend and yours, Bart Sullivan, is with us.
Howdy.
We have the bald and the beautiful, Mike Searle and Suzanne Searle.
Hello.
We have our amazing Falls Free Press photographer, Stephen Mulay, back with us.
Hello.
And our youth liaison, current Kent State University employee, Patrick Catanese, and his mother, who is one of our good friends and an OG Falls Free Presser, Kathy McMenemy. How's it going, guys?
Hello.
Hello.
All right, so we don't have a ton of stuff to discuss, but every time I say that, we end up going on for a long time, so we'll see what happens here. This first thing is really, it could be under the category of COVID-19, but I included it under sort of updates because even though it has to do with COVID-19, it's more of just sort of some general information. Bart might be able to speak to some of this too. So the Cuyahoga Falls Library is going to be reopening on July 22nd, which is great news for those of us who patronize the library on the regular. I know myself, I have had a book that has been due for a long time in my car, just waiting for me to return it. So I'm going to be doing that finally. I literally got a new car and took the book out of the old car and put it in the new car since COVID-19 started because of this. So I'm looking forward to getting that out of my car.
At least you took it out of the old car.
It's true. I didn't lose it. I might have gotten like an evil stare from a supernatural librarian. That's a Ghostbusters reference for you guys there. So the hours are going to remain the same as they currently are with the curbside service. They have Tuesday through Thursday hours and Saturday hours. The first 30 minutes of each day are going to be for sort of grab-and-go services with limited browsing for vulnerable populations, again, because of COVID-19. They have installed a lot of plastic shields and things around the library to help with social distancing and just keeping people safe. And they're also removing high-touch items from circulation. Bart, what are some examples of high-touch items?
This happened at the very beginning of quarantine, actually. Things like blocks and most of the Library of Things materials were removed. Things that get touched regularly, blocks, card games, anything that would be touched by multiple people at one time.
So a lot of stuff like in the kids area downstairs.
A lot of the kids' stuff was cleaned up or just put away. Most of the Library of Things, I think, are only that are still available were like Rokus, Wi-Fi hotspots, and things like that that are basically set up and left alone.
Right on, yeah. So we should mention Bart does work for the Cuyahoga Falls Library. He, of course, does not speak on behalf of the library, but he can give us some specific information about that kind of stuff. It also says here that the computers have been rearranged in order to allow for social distancing. But it also says that computers will be available by appointment in August.
I haven't heard anything about how the computers are going to be used, only seeing how the adult area has been rearranged.
Right on. Well, that's good news. Everybody likes to use the library for different reasons. Obviously, people go in there to use computers, and but also, you know, to get movies and check out books and all kinds of stuff that the library provides for us. So I'm glad that they're reopening. We can shift gears to talk about COVID-19. So obviously, the big news here is that one day after several counties in Ohio were proclaimed, you know, a high enough level of at risk that people were required to wear masks outside their houses, Summit County got added to that list. And so, of course, now we all have to wear masks when we go places, or at least you would think that we have to. But there's still a lot of people who are not wearing masks. And I can tell you about some of the things that I saw today. Basically, the Summit County at level 3 risk alert mandates facial coverings at all times, including indoor locations aside from your own residence, and outdoors if you're not able to socially distance, and if you're waiting for transit. The businesses who post about people being required to wear masks in the business can consider to refuse people and call the police, and it can be considered trespassing. So that's obviously a big deal. What have you guys seen as far as the mask mandate?
We went out to eat this past weekend, and the restaurant, which I'm not going to name, we did not enforce the mask mandate, and we were told because they didn't want to chase around away customers. Yeah, we witnessed we're sitting in the patio, only people out there on the patio, and people were eating inside. At least 3 or 4 people come in over a period of about half an hour and who were not wearing masks, and maybe 10 of the people who were wearing masks. So it's dependent on the restaurant when it's going to be enforced or the particular store. It's up to them essentially. If they want to call the cops on them or to report them for trespassing, which I don't blame them for not wanting to do it from a business standpoint. You know, they're going to chase away customers and piss off people. And should they be enforcing it? Absolutely. But
they're not going to have any customers if everybody gets sick because nobody's wearing masks.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, but I'm just telling you that what I saw, and also I see both sides of that.
Yeah.
You know, if my business depended on a steady stream of customers, at one point you're not mandating masks, then you're going to piss out the people who want people to wear masks. Yeah. On the other hand, too, if you're really worried, most people are ordering out instead of eating at the restaurant.
Right.
If you really are concerned.
I mean, what is the recourse for somebody who's not wearing a mask? What can the stores or restaurants do? Do they just, if they call the police, do they get a ticket?
What Bart put on the outline here was that it would be considered trespassing if you were refusing to comply and the business decided to call. Because essentially, I guess what it means is that, you know, the county's saying you have to wear a mask so the business can put up a sign that says, hey, we're complying with this. You have to wear a mask. If you come in and you're not wearing a mask and you won't leave, then it's trespassing. If you've been asked to leave, then it, you know what I mean?
So it's the owners of the store or the restaurants that are going to have to enforce this.
Yeah.
And then if they aren't leaving or they refuse to put a mask on, then they have to call the police to come and take care of the issue.
If they want to deal with that. I mean, I was actually wondering that if I'm at the gas station and a cop pulls up to get a cup of coffee and there's somebody in there not wearing a mask, does he throw them out? Does he ticket them? Does he arrest them? You know what I mean?
I don't know. I don't know who enforces it. And I think that's kind of the questionable thing is, you know, what's the appetite for enforcing something like this? I mean, Mike and I went to the grocery store yesterday, and I would say the majority of the people were wearing masks, but we did see a couple families that were not wearing masks. I mean, a mom and a dad and a couple kids, they were all, you know, kind of running around not wearing a mask. And then we saw another family that wasn't wearing a mask. I mean, so I was kind of curious why the grocery store would allow them in. My understanding is that if you have a health issue, and I say that in quotation because I don't know exactly what health issue you would have to would qualify for not wearing a mask, that I wouldn't think the whole family would have the same health issue that they couldn't wear a mask. So I'm not sure who's supposed to be enforcing this, and I don't know. I just,
well, even if it is, if we're following the similar model to what Akron did, it's more of a civil punishment versus a criminal punishment. So it's just a fine. You know, I don't know what the fine is, what the dollar amount is, but at what point, I mean, how much do you want to micromanage, you know, all these little things? I mean, I think it kind of should go back to how it was when we had the lockdown or the quarantine, where, say, Meyer, you had people at the doors, said you can only have so many people in and you have to have a mask. So you don't run into the problem of people walking in there without masks. You know, it's just, to me, it's asinine. You know, if we have a county mandate that says you have to wear a mask, wear the damn mask. It's not that hard.
Right. It's not that hard. It's not that difficult, and it's uncomfortable. I mean, I have asthma, and it's not always the most comfortable for me. And occasionally, if I am in the store, I will go find a spot that has nobody around me at all, take it off for a second to kind of readjust and breathe, and then go back on with my life. I mean, it's not that difficult to do. And I don't understand why it seems to be, it almost has become political, right? I mean, it's a political statement now, not wearing one.
It's the American thing to do. You tell us to do something, and we say, right, F you, I'm not going to do it.
It's all about my freedom and not, you know, I've actually seen on social media a few stores that are posting that they will not enforce masks.
Yeah.
And they will not be wearing masks either. And these are store places that are selling food. So, I mean, that's kind of scary. And they claim it's their, you know, it's
their freedom.
It's their freedom,
right,
to do it. So,
yeah. I've got a friend who complained when I posted that Summit County was a level 3 and required masks. And she's like, I don't like wearing a mask. I have to wear one all day at work. And she's a cake decorator.
Yeah.
And that's
welcome
pretty scary.
The fact that the store she works at didn't require it before COVID.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of worrisome.
Scary. Very worrisome. You know, I don't like wearing a mask, but I also do not like wearing a ventilator and kind of, you know, suffocating in my own fluids. I mean, call me crazy, but
that was dark.
That's kind of my thought, but
welcome to the dark side.
We went out to lunch today and there was a few people wearing a mask. Our waitress had hers at her chin. Then she pulled it up again, then pulled it down. It was kind of like half-assed how some restaurants are going about it and just businesses in general.
Yeah, the nose sticking out thing is really, it really bothers me. I can't, it's like, really? Like, what, you know?
Yes. What is the point of that?
What's the point of wearing it?
Yeah, or they'll take it off to talk to somebody. I've noticed that sometimes where they will walk up to somebody and then take it down so they can talk. It's like you're missing the whole entire point of wearing it. So,
my understanding is that the police, since it's when there's an infraction inside of a restaurant, even if you document it, it's really some public property. So it's really a civil matter. So the owner would have to complain to the police that the people were not complying, and then they would be removed for trespassing. But I think the police really only have the ability to give you a ticket if you're on public property and you're not 6 feet apart from someone else.
Yeah.
That you're not, you don't cohabitate with, which would be difficult to prove one way or the other from a distance as a cop is driving by. So literally, if they wanted to be a pain in the ass about it, they would could spend all day investigating whether somebody needs to wear a mask or not. I really doubt if a lot of police officers are to go through that much trouble unless someone's been reported.
Yeah, so I was in Akron today, and I went to a restaurant called Akron Family Restaurant. Not a single customer was wearing a mask, and it was crowded. All of the servers were wearing masks, but the woman who was at the front, kind of like seating people and ringing up people when they were paying for their food, was sort of half-heartedly wearing her mask. When I walked through the door, I saw her like quickly put it on. So there's some sense that she was like, you know, trying to like protect herself. I happened to be in another restaurant, a sandwich shop in Akron. One of the people who was actually behind the counter making food was not wearing a mask. He was wearing gloves, and, just, you know, maybe 3 feet away from him was somebody who was ringing people up for their food. He was also not wearing a mask. And then I had to do a little bit of grocery shopping. I went to Walmart. Everyone in Walmart was wearing a mask, and they have a sophisticated line situation where you have to go through. A guy tells you, there was a guy who tried to come in the store behind me who wasn't wearing a mask. The guy outside I think the guy who wasn't wearing the mask said to the other guy who was standing there, "Do I need a mask?" And the guy said, "We are asking customers to wear a mask." And so he turned around and went and got a mask. I went inside the store, did some shopping. I was over by the pharmacy, and there was an older gentleman who was not wearing a mask. As I was checking out, I was in the self-checkout. The little stupid light kept going off. Like, the girl kept having to come over and help me and scan her thing and do the enter the code, you know. And at some point, she was standing over there, and I said, "Are you guys requiring people to wear masks?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, there's a guy over there who's not wearing a mask." And she said, "Well, you know, we're telling people that we want them to wear masks, but we're not throwing people out." You know, she's like, "Ultimately, we have to do business, so we're not going to enforce it in that way." And I just think that's a cop out. You know, I really do. But to its credit, Walmart is really trying to get people to wear masks. And from what I could see, that was really helping. Now, because I buy a lot of weird shit because I'm a vegetarian and I guess kind of a hippie, I also had to go to Giant Eagle to get my fancy soap. And so I went into Giant Eagle. There's a guy sitting behind a table with a package of disposable masks who I guess it's his job to stop people and get them to wear a mask. And he had some kind of a clipboard or something, too. It looked like people, like, he was writing stuff down. So maybe people have to sign in or something. I don't know. But that was kind of my experience with it today. And I did learn that there is... So in Cuyahoga County, they set up a phone number that you could call to report people if they weren't wearing masks. It was horribly overwhelmed. And that was the news that you saw about that. Not that it had been set up or that it was working, but that it was overwhelmed. And then so I looked to see if there was something like it in Summit County. Summit County Public Health has a form that you can go on. You have to enter your name, your email address, the name of the business, its address, and then you get a little box where you can make a description to say, you know, if somebody's not wearing a mask or whatever and you want to report it. So, I mean, you know, that's all sort of part and parcel of the conversation. But I don't know that any of those things, I don't know. From my perspective, at least, it seems like more people were wearing masks today and yesterday because of this order. But it makes it that much more obvious when somebody isn't.
Yeah, so my friend actually started working at Walmart, and they actually had him do the thing where they tell people that they can come in if they have a mask on. So he posted something today about how he got yelled at by somebody, and I guess somebody told him, "It's my body, my choice." And he was like, "Well, that was going to happen someday." So
it's their body, their choice when it's them being forced to wear a mask. But
when it's them, right?
That's so ironic. Imagine if they had a uterus.
How old is your friend, Patrick, if you don't mind me asking?
But my age.
Your age. See, I don't know if that's right for stores to put, you know, young adults out there trying to stop, you know.
I agree.
Right?
I think it puts them in a very, you know, volatile position. You don't know how someone's going to react. You got really a young kid or even an elderly person or whatever. Some people are pretty obnoxious in how they react to people.
Yes.
there was a sheriff deputy at the exit of Giant Eagle. But the girl at Walmart had told me that the Stowe police had told them flat out that they weren't going to respond to calls that had to do with masks. We talked about this a little bit the last meeting. We can briefly touch on it. The Cuyahoga Falls City School District did announce these plans for the learning options in the upcoming school year. There's been a lot of discussion over the weekend and this week about what's going to happen with the schools, in part because the president, was trying to say that we need to open schools no matter what. The Secretary of Education was saying all that stuff on TV shows and stuff too over the weekend. And here in Cuyahoga Falls, the deal is basically, as we reported last week, that parents will have the option to send their children to school 2 days per week. And that'll make it so that the school district can split the school population in half and allow for social distancing to the best of their ability. And then if parents don't want to send their kids to school in person, they'll have the option to do sort of a virtual academy, an online education, 100% instead of, going to the building in any way. As I mentioned last week, my concern about that, of course, is just kids on IEPs who need, in-person therapies and things like that. But, our listeners can listen to episode 4 for my thoughts about that. And then the school district's going to survey parents next month to find out what they want to do, whether they want to send them in 2 days a week or do the online academy. So what do you guys think? Are we going to have a big in-person population this year?
Who knows? I mean, time will tell. And I think that this is all evolving. It depends on, in a month, a lot can change. Who knows where this virus is going? So right now, just kind of the pulse of social media, which I'm not sure if that's the best way of gauging people's,
Facebook.
I think that there will probably be a lot of parents wanting to send their kids. And even if it's for 2 days, a week, they definitely seem like they want them to go 5 days a week.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
I haven't read the press release from the Cuyahoga Falls Board of Education, but I was wondering if anybody has attempted to address the issue, what happens if a teacher comes down with COVID and they don't have enough vacation time or sick days in order to recover, because sometimes it could take up to 2-3 weeks or even a month to recover from this if they ever get back to 100%. And then what about, there's also already a shortage of subs, and I'm sure a lot of subs aren't going to want to go risk their lives to go teach in an environment like this, unless there's some kind of hazard pay. So I'm just kind of wondering how they're going to go through all this stuff and they're going to figure this out, because it just seems like it's just a big cluster.
Right, because without, testing for immunity, contact tracing, all that stuff, it's just there's no way for us to know.
The immunity problem now is now they're discovering that the immunity sometimes only lasts a few weeks. You can get COVID, recover, and then the immunity is gone within 2 weeks to a month, and then you can get it again. And so which means if they ever do develop a vaccine, it might be ineffective after a month.
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, I want my kids to be able to go to school, but, I haven't really, decided. My wife and I don't think we've even, we've talked about it, but I don't know that we've gone, okay, this is definitely what we're going to do when the survey gets to us, the other thing that's happening sort of outside Cuyahoga Falls is in a state like Florida, where they were quick to reopen as much stuff as they possibly could, they then set a record for new cases. Everyone could have predicted that was going to happen, right? I actually saw something somewhere in the media where it said that if Florida was its own country, it would be fourth most cases in the world of a single day. And then California, of course, they reopened a lot of stuff, but then they have now decided to close back down bars and movie theaters and a lot of those things because of the rise in cases that happened as a result.
What I think is kind of funny is reading some of the comments on Facebook and whatnot are people quoting reports from the Akron Beacon Journal and other newspapers that, well, we've had zero deaths over the past, you know, couple days or couple weeks or whatever, and we're going back into lockdown and this and that. I'm like, it doesn't necessarily matter how many deaths there are. It's how many new infections and what the rate is on how they're going to adjust things by county and start shutting things down, you know, and the deaths will come, you know. Thankfully, they haven't risen in the past couple, you know, days, weeks, whatever, but the trend's going to go up with more infections. You're going to have more deaths. Just give it time.
And you also have to worry about hospitals that are taking on these cases. Even if they don't die, they have to take care, you know, of the patients that are having these severe symptoms. And that stops them to be able to help somebody who might have, you know, cancer, or maybe they have, you know, like taking your kid to get it, you know, because they have a severe ear infection and they're, you know, you have to take them into the hospital and they don't have enough staff to be able to handle it. I mean, there's a lot of issues with that. I am kind of curious about the school. If a teacher does test positive, what about the kids that they, you know, he or she was in contact with? Would they then have to stay home for 14 days? Have they talked about that? I mean, it just, how is this going to work? I mean,
well, I think the community is going to have a lot of questions for the Board of Education. I believe it's actually tomorrow that they're going to review the plans at their meeting. So it would be interesting to attend that meeting and see, you know, how well attended it is, because I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of people sort of on the other side of this argument who just want kids back in school 5 days a week. And it's for various reasons. I mean, it could be that they're the insane, like, don't take away my freedoms, I'm not wearing a mask, you know, people. But it could also be people who just, you know, are going to struggle to find somebody to watch their kids. They're not going to be able to go to work because they can't find daycare, you know, whatever. So there are a lot of different reasons that it can be, you know, difficult under these circumstances.
And they want their kids to get an education. I mean, a lot of kids are, you know, aren't able to do the online well. And I mean, I don't blame them. I would want my kids to go back into school too.
Yeah. Well, and we talked last week about the efficacy of that sort of education.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
You know, it's just, there's a lot of factors in this.
Yeah. So I actually, I don't know if you guys saw, but somebody on one of the groups tried saying, like, well, there's been 100,000 deaths, and that's not even 1% of Ohio's population. And it's like, so you're telling me that it doesn't matter that there's that many deaths. And then he literally went on to say, oh yeah, people die all the time anyway. It just doesn't make any sense. It's like, yeah, people die in car accidents. Does that mean we shouldn't prevent car accidents?
Yeah, right. No more seatbelts, guys. I mean, from the beginning, this argument about like how many people die from the flu every year was infuriating to me, because it was like, what you're saying is, oh, well, the number of people who have died is the same number of people who die from the flu every year. It's like, yeah, but all those people who got the flu and died, they all still died, right? This is 30,000 more people who died, and now it's 40,000 people almost who have died in this country. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It would be nice if there was a way to like survey the parents and see how many are going to do best in school versus how many are not going to do best in school, maybe stay home, because everybody's situation is going to be different. Someone with young kids might need the school because they have to go to work, and maybe they don't have that choice to not go back to work. And then, but some people older, especially high school kids, might be able to do work from home. And they may find that it's, you know, like half and half. And maybe they could just split up the classes differently so that the ones that are going to do best remote, let them be remote. And the ones that need in person, let them be in person. And maybe it would still be able to socially distance that way, to where you have so many people handling all the remote classes and so many people doing the in school.
That's a very interesting population to do it based on their academic performance, or just their ability to respond to online education. In Woodridge, they are working on a virtual academy for families who are unsure about going back because of the pandemic. they're going to help them. That's going to help them with credit recovery and some kind of an alternative to expulsion. And then they're also going to try to, you know, get resident children to come back who have gone out to charter schools and stuff like that. So this is something that they're talking about in the Woodridge District too. I think most of us live in Falls School District, so we do tend to focus on that more. But Woodridge is also struggling with this and dealing with it in its own way. So that's worth mentioning at least. So in the arts, in the area of the arts, we did see a mural go up on the side of Cuyahoga Valley Arts Center last week by Ron White. It was a really interesting mural of a guy kind of like blowing bubbles, but the bubbles were heart-shaped, and then inside each bubble was like another little drawing. Did you guys see it?
I saw pictures on Facebook that the Downtown Partnership had posted, but I never got to see the full thing.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. I don't know what I was expecting, so it was nice to see that kind of art down there. And then so they're actually continuing that this week. The artist's name is Max Love, and on Thursday that'll go up, I assume, weather permitting. And it's going to be on the Testa building. Well, there is a really cool Instagram page that's the Downtown Cuyahoga Falls Partnership that I would encourage everybody to follow. We interviewed Abby Paskey, the executive director, for an earlier podcast through the Falls Free Press. That's up on our YouTube page that you can check out. That was very early in the COVID-19 sort of shutdown. But she posts a lot of pictures on their Instagram channel and on Facebook that just are kind of like really good ways to appreciate how beautiful our downtown is now. And she posted the stuff about or the pictures of the mural by Ron White on the side of CVAC right there at the corner of sort of at the corner of Front Street and Portage Trail. Near the coffee shop is where that mural was. And so this one will be on the Testa building. And Max Love is going to put that up there on July 16th. And this was a juried entry process where artists submitted what they were going to do. It's a really interesting way for the community to kind of get used to the idea of public art. And there was a public art master plan that we covered over the period of a few months. They had a big board of people who were trying to basically delineate the rules that were going to be required for artists to follow before any kind of permanent public art could go up. So this is a nice kind of soft launch of public art in the city. And it also replaces a festival that they were going to have where they were going to have contests for art down on Falls River Square that was going to be chalk art. Since that was canceled because of COVID-19, they did this juried process with some professional artists instead. And I look forward to seeing what Max Love puts up on the 16th, but you should still be able to see what Ron White put up on the Instagram channel and social media channels of the Downtown Cuyahoga Falls Partnership. So I hope everybody checks that out. There are some really good sponsors, including the Cuyahoga Valley Arts Center, but also Collide Cuyahoga Falls. And if you don't know about Collide, it's really cool. It's a citywide organization that's just a patron of the arts. They raise money to help artists and also bring artists to Cuyahoga Falls. In the time I've been here, a lot of really cool sort of art shows and galleries and things have been put together by them, including one in which they had several different works of art from artists around the Northeast Ohio area in various locations around the city. And at that time, I was going to the Natatorium a lot, and there was a really cool picture inside the Natatorium that every day I walked past it and just really admired this piece. And I found out later that there was a guy who worked at the Natatorium who just fell in love with this piece. And every time the artist came in, just went on and on about how he loved this piece. And the artist gave the piece to this kid who worked at the Natatorium. So I thought that was really cool. I'll see if I can dig up the name of that artist and maybe get a picture of the piece from the folks at Collide Cuyahoga Falls so that you guys can check that out. But Collide really is a great thing for our city, especially as we sort of grow into a slightly more progressive city, particularly within the arts. So also Right Brain Design Group, which is Matt Weiss's graphic design company. We know Matt Weiss very well, of course. He designed the logo for the Falls Free Press. And then the Metro RTA, they got doing that too, sponsoring to chalk it up. So look for that on July 16th. All right, awesome. So this is a good conversation, and we look forward to talking again next week. And we appreciate all our Fallscast listeners, and stay tuned after this for an interview with AJ Harris. Thanks for listening. See you guys all later.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're here on the Fallscast with dog lover, cat tolerator, and former candidate for the 36th District of the Ohio State House of Representatives, AJ Harris, Falls native too. AJ, how you doing, man?
Good, good. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. So the Falls Free Press started nearly 3 years ago now, and the last time somebody from Cuyahoga Falls ran for the 36th District House of Representatives, State House of Representatives seat, was Noah Spinner, who was an 18-year-old, fresh out of high school. I believe he was actually campaigning during his senior year of high school. And he was a very interesting character. We really had a good time covering him and you know, hearing from him over the course of the primary campaign. And he ultimately lost to Tim Pyatt, who, you know, is somebody from Canton.
Another great guy.
Yeah. And so one of the main reasons I want to talk to you is because your campaign, even though you, like Noah, were ultimately unsuccessful in the primary, was really inspiring to Cuyahoga Falls people. The voters here in Cuyahoga Falls, you know, I saw a lot of AJ Harris signs. I really did. I did not see a lot of Matt Shaughnessy signs. He did very well in the Falls. I think that was surprising and something of an upset for a lot of Democrats here, even though, you know, we all, I think, support him moving forward. And honestly, you guys were both great candidates for a lot of different reasons, and different candidates for a lot of reasons, which maybe demonstrates the sort of giant tent of the Democratic Party, too. But, you know, we wanted to talk to you because we wanted to, you know, again, have that kind of roundup like we did with Noah. But I also don't know that a lot of people know a lot about you. With Noah, it was easy to say, here's this 18-year-old kid from Cuyahoga Falls who's really interested in politics, and he's running for State House. Boom, there you go. But AJ Harris is a guy who we don't all know very well. So can you give us a little bit of your background, kind of give us the maybe the short version of your story here?
Yeah, of course. You know, I talked a lot during the campaign about, you know, my background, and I was trying to figure out a way to resonate that with a lot of people around here, because I was not born and raised in Cuyahoga Falls. I'm from Zanesville, Ohio. It's about an hour and 30 minutes south of here. You know, I didn't go to school in the Akron area. I went to school at Miami University down outside Cincinnati.
Also my alma mater.
Yeah, right. And then, you know, Alicia and I, you know, around 2012, we decided, you know, we are young, you know, we both wanted to, you know, do some traveling. So we moved out to Los Angeles and we lived out there for about 5 years. I worked in the entertainment business. Alicia worked as a waitress to keep us afloat for a while. And then she got into interior design, and she did that. But, you know, 2016 election happened. I decided, you know, I needed to get back to Ohio. I wanted to follow in my mother's footsteps. My mom's a teacher. She's been a teacher for 20 plus years. So I decided to pursue my master's in education at Walsh University. I started teaching at Akron Public Schools as a long-term substitute teacher. I got lucky and got a entire year gig teaching seventh grade world history, which, you know, taught me a lot as, you know, not just as an educator, but as a person as well, being immersed into a classroom of predominantly low-income Black students. That's different from the you know, where I grew up. You know, we had Black kids and white kids, but it was predominantly white schools. So, you know, being immersed in that classroom like that was a teachable moment for myself as well. So I went on, you know, I did that. I needed something that was a little better with my school schedule. So I decided to take a job as a job developer, which I currently do. I help students and adults with disabilities throughout Summit County find work. And as you can imagine, with, you know, not a lot of people working right now, it's been rather difficult time for my clients, you know, trying to keep them, one, motivated to a lot of my high school kids, especially, you know, trying to keep them motivated to, you know, keep looking for a job. But also, you know, a lot of my adult clients as well, you know, there's not the job market wasn't good to begin with and it's even worse right now. So so that's kind of my background. That's what I'm doing now. I live in Cuyahoga Falls, as you said, over on Sackett, down the street from Laconi's with my wife, my two dogs, and our beloved cat.
Don't you lie to me.
So that's a little bit of, my background.
AJ and I are making jokes for the listeners here because it wasn't that long ago that the Falls Free Press came to AJ's house and made a little video where we sort of told parts of that same story in a video format. And I just remember one of the lines being, yes, you said something like, we have two dogs. And there was a pause. And then he said, and a cat, as if to say, well, yeah, there's also a cat, but, you know.
Right.
So Alicia is from Cuyahoga Falls, right?
Yes, she was born and raised here. We actually live in the house next door to the house she grew up in. So, you know, we kind of did this full circle across the United States and ended up right back to where it all started for her. So,
well, it's a good place to end up. Where did you meet Alicia?
I met Alicia in 2010 or 2011 at Miami.
Awesome. So can you tell us a little bit about what you actually did in California? Because I think that's really interesting.
Like I mentioned, in college, I ran a student organization where I booked musicians to come and play at local bars. That's where I kind of got bit by the entertainment bug. I had a friend move out to Los Angeles. He was a year ahead of me. So he graduated and went out to Los Angeles and got a job at a entertainment. I think he was working at a talent agency, maybe. And he said, you got to come out here. You got to try it. You know, Alicia and I always had, like I said, we always wanted to travel out west. So we did it. I moved out there. I got a 3-month internship, unpaid, obviously, because it is California and it's the entertainment business. So 3-month unpaid internship at Interscope Records working for one of Kanye West's producers. And it sounds cool, but it wasn't. I worked out of a studio house. So it was this huge mansion in Tarzana, California, right outside Los Angeles. And I was a runner. I would run and get them food. I would run, to this day, I still have their Chick-fil-A orders memorized. but after that, you know, I talked to Alicia. I'm like, this is not what I want to do with my life. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to wait hand and foot on, you know, these guys. So I took a assistant job at a talent agency. I worked in a commercial department. We helped book commercials for a lot of our clients, and then moved my way up from there until my boss had the idea of starting a literary department. She knew that I was trying to, you know, expand my horizon in Los Angeles, so she tasked me with starting the literary department, and I kind of built it from the ground up. It was fun. You know, I always tell people I got a little bit of business experience. You know, you're kind of, you know, even though it's a department within a company, you are still kind of starting your own business. I was making all my own contacts. I was finding all my own clients, reading all my own scripts, stuff like that. So, yeah, I kind of got into that. You know, there it is, a lavish world of Los Angeles. You get to go to premieres. You get to go to, you know, you walk red carpets until you get to a point where you're like, oh, I don't want to walk this red carpet, you know?
First world problems.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's that's kind of what it's like. And I tell everyone it was an easy transition from being in that world, getting into the world of politics. I mean, because it's very similar. It is very similar. There are people you have to you have to appease, and politics is very much like that.
Well, it's interesting that you had this background in entertainment. You ended up back here, and you kind of, you started back at the bottom in some ways, right? I mean, you guys came back to Cuyahoga Falls, which I'm sure was great for Alicia, and I know you fell in love right away. You talked about, you know, wanting to live the Cuyahoga Falls life, have a house on Broad Boulevard, right, and all of that. But what you ultimately ended up doing when you got back here was, you were a bartender at Market District, right?
Mm-hmm. I was. It was, you talk about that transition. You know, you were working, I was working a white collar job out in LA. You know, I was a literary agent. You know, that's kind of what I wanted to do, and I did it out there. But, you know, coming back, and I'm not going to lie, there was kind of an ego thing. I looked at myself in the mirror on my first day of going into bartending. I'm like, you know, what the hell am I doing? I was, a literary agent 2 months ago out in Los Angeles, and now I'm bartending at a grocery store in Ohio. So it was, you know, it was a huge, you know, eye opener for me, but I learned so much from going back and starting at square one. And I think it needed to be done because, you know, Alicia and I did a lot of struggling out in Los Angeles. We made, you know, every success we had, we earned at ourselves. We worked really hard for that. And we struggled very, very much. And we had a struggle when we moved back here. Neither of us come from money. So we started again from, you know, square one, worked our way up from there. I kind of used the money, you know, as bartending. I started teaching as well, but I needed to work those two jobs. And I think I talked about this during the campaign, and I could go on for hours about, you know, teachers, you know, a lot of teachers have second jobs. A lot of them have third jobs because they're not making enough in the classroom. So I needed a lot of that to do, obviously, starting back at square one. But it was a shock. It was a culture shock too, coming from Los Angeles to back to Ohio, you know, where you know, we, Los Angeles is the progressive I would love to see, you know, that level of progressive I would love to see throughout the country. Sadly, you know, it's taking a little longer, but it was a culture shock. It was coming back here. And I tell a lot of people this, you know, even moving out to Los Angeles, I moved out to Los Angeles with my own biases, you know, with my own, I realized I was prejudiced, having been born and raised in Ohio in a small town, that was predominantly white town, and then moving out to Los Angeles, this huge melting pot of people. And, you know, it was an adjustment as well. So I had to adjust to, you know, Los Angeles, then adjusting, you know, getting back to my levels in Ohio here. So
you're back, you've been bartending. A lot of names and a lot of people sort of were showing interest in, well, let's back up. The current Ohio State representative in the state legislature, the House of Representatives, is a Republican who's term limited, Anthony DeVitas. So he's term limited this time around. He'd been challenged before. He was challenged by Paul Colavecchio, who was an at-large councilman and a ward councilman in Cuyahoga Falls. Noah Spinner, 2017, and now he's term limited. A lot of people who I talked to prior to the primary were not really sure who was going to run. You know, I had talked to at least one person who wasn't really interested in running because, as a practicing lawyer, the attitude was kind of, you know, you don't even get to practice law, and you have to move to Columbus. You come back after your term limit is over, or if you're beaten, and now you're all that time without having practiced. So it's right. Not something that's right. Especially attractive to lawyers. You know, it's attractive to some local politicians, but of course the Republican who currently holds the seat was difficult to beat. In fact, it never was beaten. So, you know, people weren't really sure what was going to happen this time around. Of course, Matt Shaughnessy from Green, who ended up winning the primary, you know, former policeman, firefighter, Green City Councilman, ran for mayor and was narrowly defeated in Green, which is saying a lot right. If you're a Democrat. And then AJ Harris. So take us through, because, you know, I think a lot of people think that when you see somebody on TV say they're not sure if they're going to run for something, you know, that means they're going to run, right? Mm-hmm. But it's true that when you're thinking this through, it's difficult. And even if you lean toward doing it, you're kind of like, I'm still not really sure. You know, I think right. It really takes going to the Board of Elections and signing the paperwork to really feel like, okay, I'm doing this, you know? So take us through, you know, that process, because not only were you running in that primary, but you were really preparing heavily. So yeah, again, just take us through kind of how you got to the decision. What were some of the mm-hmm. hurdles, you know, personally that you had to deal with in deciding to right. run and all that?
You know, I mean, to run for state, I sat down, you know, I originally wanted to run for city council. So I started looking at, you know, where I was living and, you know, who was running. I met the amazing Susan Spinner and said, no, you know, Susan's the one. She's fantastic. So I didn't, you know, I didn't want to pursue anything in the city. But then I sat down with Alicia and started, you know, talking about exactly what I cared about. And that fell on my own background, education. You know, I grew up in public housing, you know, my family history with opioid use. So I looked at, you know, a lot of those issues and where I could make the greatest impact. And that was in the State House. So I decided to, you know, it was more asking around. I met with a few local leaders in the area and, you know, got their opinions on the matter and met with former candidates themselves, got their opinions on things, and ultimately made a decision to do it. But, you know, I was nervous, and I was a first time candidate running for state office. So it's something to be nervous about. And what was running through my head was, you know, number one, am I good enough for this? You know, we look at people who usually run for this position, and you had mentioned lawyers, you know, they have a law degree or they have been in city council for a number of years, like Matt has, you know, stuff like that. And I didn't have that background. I'm a lowly job developer, living in Cuyahoga Falls, who taught for a year, in an inner city school district and, had a background in entertainment, you know? So I was nervous about it. I really was. But, when I made that ultimate decision to do it, I knew that, you know, one, having the, not the approval, I guess, but having the blessing of my wife, having the blessing of a lot of my family members, because their history would be pulled out as well and put into public. You know, so I was a little worried about, you know, some of the stuff I might have done in the past, you know, coming to light, a lot of the stuff my family may have done in the past coming to light. So there's so much stuff going through my head. But ultimately made a decision to do it. And you had mentioned that, you know, in the beginning, you know, we kind of impressed a lot of people around here. And I want to give credit to the young people I had working for my campaign. See, that's, you know, I brought on Zach Kaiser to be my campaign manager.
Yeah, but it wasn't just Zach. I mean, you had like a room full of like college age people.
And I remember the first meeting I had with Zach when I asked him to be my campaign manager was over spaghetti dinner here at my house. And I told him I wanted to do something different, that we needed to be different. We don't want to be like a normal, you know, we don't want to be like candidates of the past. We have to do something different. And the way we went about that was recruiting young people, energizing young people. And I think we did a hell of a job doing that. I'm so happy. You know, obviously I'm upset that we lost because they put in so much work, but I'm so happy to see a lot of them working for other campaigns right now too. We lit a fire under them to get involved, and they're staying involved and they're doing everything they can to make sure that we end up flipping two House seats in this fall. And, you know, we flip the presidency too. So they are staying involved, which is great. So, you know, that's kind of, I don't know if I answered your question, you know, all the way through, but that's kind of the progression through everything. And, you know, kind of what we, you know, what I wanted to do to be different candidate. And I think we were successful at doing that.
Yeah. Now, how did you know Zach Kaiser before this?
I didn't. Actually, I took a meeting with Troy with the Summit Dems. Troy's a fantastic guy. I took a meeting with him and he said, you know what, you should sit down and talk to Zach Kaiser. He's been, you know, thinking about running for office, maybe this same seat. So I'm like, okay. Kind of push it under the table. I never went about it. And Zach actually reached out to me. We had a meeting down at Astrid Coffee Shop downtown on Front Street. We hit it off. I loved his ideas. I loved his passion. He had his finger on the pulse of the happenings around here in the Falls, and I needed someone like that on my side. And again, his ability to motivate a lot of young people to come on board was another thing I saw in him, and it just kind of took off from there.
Yeah. Yeah, like I say, your campaign, it really was amazing in that sense, that, you know, you had so many young people there, and I think that was inspiring to a lot of people in Cuyahoga Falls. in particular, I think that probably a lot of people who listen to this, you know, would have been surprised, you know, that you weren't successful. Now, we knew going in that Green has a really big impact on this seat, not just in the primary, but in the general. And, you know,
right.
One of the big reasons DeVitas has been able to keep the seat for as long as he has, because Green has such a big say.
Right.
I think it's one of the reasons that people thought Tim Pyatt might be able to be successful.
And Tim came close. I mean, he, I wasn't around for his campaign, but the stories I hear, they ran a hell of a campaign, you know. Yeah. And, you know, Tim was actually the person who said, you're going to go back and look at, you know, the corpse, you know, of your campaign if you lose. And you're going to find so many things you wish you would have done better. And, you know, just build on those for next time. Build on them for next time. So, I know, I learned a lot from Tim over these last few months of running. So,
well, so what did the autopsy reveal then?
What it revealed is that we, and I don't want to, I hope I don't piss anyone off when I say this, but we were a little ahead of this district, I think. We were a little ahead of voters. I think we ran a very, very powerful online campaign. I was all over social media. You know, it was, I loved when I would go, I think we knocked on about 2,500 doors during the primary, you know, going around and knocking on doors and then having someone say, AJ, I just saw you when I was scrolling through Facebook. I saw one of your ads. I love that. You know, that's what we were doing differently. And I just think it was way ahead of where we are right now. I think we should have ran a more old fashioned, and I think Matt did this, I'm not exactly sure, but I think he ran a more old fashioned mailing campaign than doing more of the social media kind of stuff. So I just think that was a little, maybe a little ahead of the times here in this district. I just don't think they were kind of, and, you know, it could have been me. The fact that I hadn't, you know, I know Matt compared our experiences a lot during the campaign with a couple mailers. That could have gotten to a lot of the older voters around here. They saw Matt's experience and maybe didn't understand my lived experience I was running on at the time, you know? So there were several things we sat down, we're like, we could have done differently, but it wasn't a lot, because I feel like we ran a hell of a campaign. And I don't think we had a single person on our team who didn't carry their weight. So the corpse, there's a corpse there. I'm still, sometimes I just don't want to look at it right now, but you know, over time I'll dive back into that and see what we can do better next time.
Okay, so you know, you lose the primary, somewhat surprisingly, at least amongst people in Cuyahoga Falls. Certainly people were disappointed. There was a little bit of drama on social media, as one might expect. You eventually get to a place where, and I think we saw this on a national level with, you know, the progressives who were supporting people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren,
right,
eventually sort of like getting over the sting of their defeat and kind of moving toward Joe Biden. Certainly not everybody, but we've seen some polls even just recently that show that, you know, I think people who support Bernie Sanders, there was only 4% of the people who were going to go vote for Trump, right?
Yeah.
And it was like 93% of the people were going to support Biden. And with Elizabeth Warren, it was like 94% of the people were going to support Biden, and there were zero people who said they would support Trump. So we saw this a little bit on the national level, but there is a sting amongst supporters, and I think amongst the candidates too. You look at somebody like Bernie Sanders, and he really took it in stride. But his supporters, not so much, even still. So talk to us about how you get from, you know, the sting of defeat to, you know, endorsing Matt. And are you doing anything to help him at this point?
You know, it was, like you said, it was a tough loss. We went into it thinking we were going to do a whole lot better than we did, and we didn't. But I think it was necessary for me at, you know, the point I did after a couple, I think it was almost a month maybe, of not coming out and supporting Matt to do it at that time. I think he had a fund, it was for a fundraiser I think he was having. And money wins these elections. I know that. I want to use the example. We raised a lot of money during the primary. So I don't want to say money wins elections because we raised a lot more than Matt did. But I know that money is going to, it's going to take money to beat Bob Young in November because the Republicans are just going to pour, you know, dollars and dollars into his campaign without him having to do much. So Matt's really going to have to, you know, work for it. So I thought, you know, it'd be good for me to voice my support for him and make sure that I am encouraging everyone who voted for me and supported me to jump on the Matt train and help get him elected in November. I think we just have to flip two seats to break that supermajority in the Ohio House. And if it's Matt, that's good. I would love to see him elected in November. So, yeah, I can remember the second part of your question.
Are you doing anything specifically to help his campaign?
You know, I am not. If they approach me and they ask for help with anything, I will more than I will help them out. You know, we're in uncharted waters right now trying to run a camp. I could only imagine what it's like running a campaign during, you know, the COVID-19 era right now. It's difficult. So I don't know, you know, exactly how his team, you know, how they're going about, you know, pushing the campaign forward. But I'm here to help out in any way I can. Like I said, we ran a great social campaign during the primary. And, you know, anytime they need help with that or any pointers on that, I'm happy to give my advice.
Do you think that the COVID-19 pandemic had a bearing on your performance in the primary? Because, you know, it was basically the night before the primary that you guys got right. The whole carpet kind of pulled out from underneath you.
Yeah, we, you know, there are going to be people out there that say, oh, AJ, whatever, you know, you would have lost anyway. But I really do. I think the virus played a huge role in, you know, moving that March 17th primary to April 28th. That's a whole, you know, the ground we had covered in our campaign, I felt, was more successful than Matt's. I don't really know because I wasn't part of his team, but I think that, you know, that moving that primary date really gave him more time to get his footing together, you know, get a couple more mailers out, get those chasers out, and round up some more votes for him. I think we were out till about 11:30 the night before the election until we finally got the last word that they had canceled. We were out ready. We were out passing out. We had flyers. We were going to hand out some literature. We were going to hand out to people walking into a lot of the polling locations. We had about 7 or 8 polling locations in the district covered with volunteers. So I look at those as votes. People were being handed my lid on the way in. There was going to have been some extra votes we could have picked up. It was just more of an opportunity for us to, especially me, I would have been working one of the elementary school polling locations all day. That would have been an opportunity for me to speak to a lot of people, and that could have been more votes I could have rounded up. So, yeah, I think that, and there was a whole confusion about when the primary date was moved. You know, my neighbor is a Republican. He wasn't going to vote for me, but he didn't vote in the primary because he did not know that the date was moved. He's not someone who's on social media. I think he said he got one little mailer from LaRose's office saying that, you know, the date has been changed, but there are a lot of people out there who are probably confused by that. So I imagine that took away some votes as well. But again, there's going to be people out there that say, AJ, you're probably going to lose anyway. But I personally feel, and my team felt, that, you know, had that election been held on March 17th, we would have done a whole lot better.
So just shifting gears a little bit here. Obviously, you know, we're seeing a pandemic and a mismanagement of that pandemic.
Right.
You know, in some places, people are doing better job than other people. Sometimes they fumble the ball, and that's one major thing that's happening in the country right now and in the world. Obviously, that's sort of like occupying, you know, the media, cycle, but, also, you know, we saw the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the killing of Breonna Taylor. And of course, we've been seeing killings like this for years and years and years and years and years.
Right.
I can remember Rodney King seeing that on the news when I was a kid. And so, you know, we have a flashpoint in the conversation surrounding police brutality, racism, white privilege, and all these things, and how they're interrelated. And it's sort of culminated in Black Lives Matter. You have been really active in that conversation since the primary. Do you want to talk us to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's I kick myself, you know, every time I would see a Black man or woman, you know, I see a video or come across the news that another, you know, Black person was murdered by a white person or a white officer. I would always, you know, it always hit me emotionally, but it would never hit me to a point where I would take action. And I don't know if I felt compelled after running for office and using my voice and the platform I gained throughout these few months doing that to start speaking up, or, you know, that George Floyd video just hit me differently. You know, watching that and, you know, hearing the guy call for his mom and, you know, seeing the knee on the neck, all the, it was like the perfect storm of emotion. And like I said, it made me feel guilty for not speaking up in the past, but, you know, being half Black and, you know, having family members whose skin are, you know, it's darker than mine, I decided that I'm going to use that platform, that voice that I've gained these last few months to speak up and speak out about the what is happening in our country. And I think, too, you had mentioned that, you know, we have COVID going on and we have, you know, George Floyd's death going on. But what it has revealed, I think, is there's a systemic problem within our country. And it goes from local, state, to federal institutions, which is the reason I went down to Columbus to testify in front of the Senate, the Ohio Senate, to urge them to pass a resolution making racism a public health crisis, because we have a systemic problem, and it's affecting Black people. It's affecting their employment, their housing, education, and it has so for years. And I think it's finally, it's taken COVID-19 to disrupt communities ways we have never seen in order to bring about that systemic racism. I think it's my job to speak up and speak out as a Black man. And so I am doing everything I can to, you know, do that and bring awareness to my white friends and family.
Do you, so I don't think a lot of people would even know necessarily that you have biracial parents, right?
And
if you take like an African American studies course or a course in African American literature or criticism or something like that, this concept of passing comes up a lot. You're not somebody who hides that, obviously, that part of yourself. But has that ever impacted? Did it impact the campaign, or is that? How do you sort of reconcile that? Reconcile is the wrong word, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I have never, and I had conversations with a lot of people about this these last few weeks. I have never been personally affected by racism. And I think that's because I have been so privileged by my lighter skin that someone looks at me and goes, you know, I used to get it all the time in college. Man, you're not Black. You're not Black. Now, come on, let me see a picture of your dad.
You got a handlebar mustache, man.
Right. Yeah. You're not Black, you know? But that used to piss me off is when I would get the, show me a picture of your dad. I'd be like, you know, one.
Really? People would say that to you.
Like, I don't have to show you a picture of my dad to prove to you I'm Black. You should take my word on that. I have been protected by my lighter skin, and I will be the first to admit that. My brother, his skin is darker than my own, and he's had some run-ins. I never really told the story. My only story I have with, you know, dealing with racism was when I was a kid, my family, we were traveling down to Florida for a family vacation. We were going through Georgia and my stepdad pulled over. There was a diner off the side of the highway. And before we got out of the car to eat, my stepdad's Black and my mom is white. Now he told us, he turned back in the seat, looked at my brother and I said, don't you look at a single person in the eye when you go in here. We're going to go in here. We're going to eat. We're going to leave. And that's exactly what we did. I didn't understand why he told me that till years later. And it was because my mom's white, a white woman, and you know, walking into a diner in Georgia with a black guy and two biracial kids, you know, it's not necessarily something that's at the time, I guess you can still say it is, it's not exactly accepted by a lot of people down there. So that's the only thing. And, you know, now that I go back and look on that story, I'm like, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. My stepdad had to turn around in his chair and tell two young kids, you know, that, you know, don't look anyone in the eye in here. You know, it could lead to something bad. And, you know, years later, understanding why, it's just, we haven't really, I don't think that needle's been moved too far. I mean, there's probably a black father turning around in the seat telling kids that today. That's kind of how I'm using, you know, my blackness to bring a voice to this movement that I think is finally seeing some progress this go around.
And you've done that by showing up at these protests, testifying in the Ohio State House and all things. So is the moment at the Georgia restaurant the closest you ever came to the talk that we hear about?
I think we've had the talk a couple times growing up. I know we had it when I went off to college, knowing that I was going to a predominantly white school.
Not just a predominantly white school, but a predominantly white privileged school. I mean, money and power and influence. Paul Ryan graduated from that college. I mean,
He most certainly did. He had some, then you have some pictures taken there too of his, you know, workout routines and stuff like that.
I don't know. My God.
But, I mean, so we had that talk then, and I think it was important for, you know, him to have that conversation with me, but it didn't really affect me the way I befriended a lot of the black kids that were at Miami, and there weren't a lot, but, we had a circle of, friends, and, you know, we never really talked about race. And of course in Oxford, you would know, you're kind of in your own little bubble. So anything that kind of happens there is handled by people within that bubble. So a lot of that stuff went out. I think Miami was just in the news for the professor who used a racial slur, I think, or something recently, and the university wasn't acting upon it. I think it's the first, I'm not saying stuff like that hasn't happened in the past, but it's the first time we've actually seen the university address issues like that. And it's the first time I actually witness, or, you know, I saw the video of the professor saying it, but witness someone within that community being overtly racist. Cause I had a lot of white friends too. I had never heard them say anything out of line, at least in front of me. So,
well, let me ask you this then, and you're going to hate this question, but I have to ask it. You have obviously built a name in Cuyahoga Falls and beyond, not just for having run, but also for your activity in recent months in, you know, the Black Lives Matter organization, the protests and all of that. You mentioned being interested before in running for city council. Do you see yourself running for office again?
I do. I'm not done. I moved back here to get involved politically, and I will, one way or another. I'm trying, you know, I could take that whole grassroots approach and build my way up. And that's what I've been told, you know, even before I decided to run for state representative, I was told that, you know, start low, start with something small like city council. And I'm never one to do the traditional route. I don't think things need to be done a traditional route. So, do I see myself running for city council? I'm not sure. Like I said, what I want to do and the change I want to make, I hope to do at a larger level. So whatever opportunity presents itself to me in the future, I will take it. Just right now, I'm trying to do my best to keep everyone on my good side. So I have that opportunity. I have that opportunity in the future.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Really great to hear your voice and you know, to contribute to the discussion here.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
We look forward to seeing what you're going to do next. And I think you have a litter box to clean.
I most certainly do. Yeah, I'll have to go check that.
I hope all the listeners will go check out the AJ for Ohio video that we made that's on the False Free Press website at falsefreepress.com. We really do appreciate you joining us, AJ. And,
of course.
We look forward to seeing what you do next, man, for real. So
awesome.
Take
Thanks,
care.
Man.
And,
I appreciate it.
Hi
take
to
care.
Alicia and all the dogs and cats.
Will do. Take care, man.
See you later, buddy.
Fallscast is a production of the Falls Free Press in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Please check out the Falls Free Press at fallsfreepress.com or on social media at facebook.com/fallsfreepress or at @falls_free on Twitter or Instagram. We thank you for listening to this episode, which was recorded and edited by Alex Hall. Please subscribe to our podcast and tell your Cuyahoga Falls friends and family so that they can listen as well.